Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome to today's segment of Afternoon Satsang, coming at our new timings of 12 p.m. IST. We will be continuing with what I think is the 72nd episode of Conversations with Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba, the book that has been beautifully written by Swami's able instrument, Dr. John Hislop. And we had done this last week as well, and this week will be a continuation of that. Right at the beginning, let me also share with all our listeners that today evening we will have yet another satsang, not the afternoon satsang, it will be like the evening satsang. It will be a video satsang that will be broadcast live on our YouTube channel, and with Bhagwan's blessings and love, both Brother Prem and myself have got the opportunity to participate in it, and that will be a satsang on how the first ever Veda Purusha Saptaha Jnana Yagna came about in Prashanti Nilayam. It was a very, very fascinating story that we discovered, and we thought it would be good to have a satsang and discussion on it so that we will feel what is Bhagwan's love, compassion on all of humanity, especially the Vedas, as we go through that satsang. But for that, you will have to wait till 7:30 p.m. Indian Standard Time. Right now, we will be getting into Conversations with Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba again, which highlights Bhagwan's immense love, grace and compassion on all of us as he explains some very, very difficult and intriguing concepts with the consummate ease that we associate with Swami alone. On that note, let us offer our most humble pranams at the lotus feet of our beloved Swami and welcome Brother Prem as well. Sairam Prem.
Sairam Arvind and Sairam to all our listeners. Yes, I think the most fascinating thing that we came across last time was a very beautiful analogy that Swami gave, and from the reaction that Hislop gave for that analogy itself, it shows that it was such a beautiful one, and where Swami speaks of not a very a pleasant thing that happens in India sometimes, where tenants end up being squatters and eventually take ownership of the house itself. We spoke of how that came about in traditional sense also. Swami gives that as an example, and Swami explained surrender through that example. Swami said, you are the person who owns your heart, your body, and the Lord comes down into the heart as a resident, as a tenant in the beginning, but slowly he takes ownership of the entire heart and your entire life. And this happens in a very gradual way, and in a, as we know, in a very loving way when it comes to Swami. And it was in response to that analogy, Hislop said, Swami, this is beautiful and this is so clear. And is it okay if I share it with devotees in America? And Swami said, why not? Definitely. So probably there might be some devotees in America who are listening to it now. Right? So, dear listeners, you had the permission to know about this way back 30, 40 years ago when Swami was explaining this analogy. And that's the beauty of this conversation, as you said. Very, very fascinating aspects of spirituality is so lucidly explained by Swami. We're going to go through that even today. Some very interesting. We may or may not be able to grasp entirely what Swami is saying, but nevertheless, I think in the appropriate time, some of these might come to our knowledge and make things more clearer then.
Going back to last week's analogy where Swami says God comes in your heart and takes over your entire heart, personally, I was just reminded of how Swami would say that when you have your home has a door, it has windows, you won't open your door for all and sundry. You will not allow pigs and animals to get into the house. You have the door to keep them out. At the same time, when a revered guest comes, you go to the door and welcome the guest. Atithi Devo Bhava, meaning the guest himself becomes God. So I just felt when Swami says you bring God to your heart and God soon becomes the owner of the heart, a tenant who becomes the master. In that sense, it's a very, very positive thing. Usually we hear the story of the Arab and the camel, where they say that the camel comes and pushes the Arab out of the house. That's in a negative sense, but this is in a positive sense, because we would love that Swami takes over our life, takes over our bodies, takes over our hearts. So the inspiration that I got was, when we are owning the body, when we feel we are in charge and our hearts have not been occupied by anything. The only care we have to take is in ensuring that we invite the right person in, which is Swami, and keep out the Arshad Vargas, hatred, envy, greed, pride, which Swami says are like the animals. Because if we do that much and take care that our heart is clean to welcome Swami, I think the rest is a natural process where Swami takes over the heart. That's how Swami was saying that all you need to do is invite God and keep him there long enough. You know, it means persevere with God for long enough, then you will see that your entire being is taken over by God. So that is the only effort that we possibly have to put in. Keep out the negative, invite the Lord inside.
Right, and I remember many episodes where Swami explained this. One of the most telling one is was narrated by Sanjay Sani sir in Swami's presence once.
Hmm.
It's about a visiting faculty. Must have been around when we were students too, Mr. Vithal Rao. He was from, I think, IIM Bangalore. He was a professor there. He used to come and teach in our MBA department too. At one point, I think it was during the 75th birthday or something, Swami comes up to him and Swami asks him, are you coming for Swami's birthday celebrations? So he said, yes, Swami, I'm coming. Swami said, you come with all your family. Swami is going to give Vishwavirata Darshan on 75th birthday. Mm. Right? And he was very happy. He went back. And unfortunately, what happened is the turn of events, a very important marriage was fixed very close to Swami's bed, Swami's birthday, and because of which he could not come. So he was in two minds whether to go for this family function or come to Swami's celebrations, because Swami had physically kind of invited him. So finally, you know, generally what we do when problems like this, we find Swami to be the more understanding person, right? Swami will understand, but the rest might not. Say, okay, we'll go after the birthday celebrations. We'll attend this family function. And it seems he gets a dream a couple of days later, in which Swami takes him into a huge mansion, and Swami shows him different rooms in the mansion. And then Swami says, you know, Vithal Rao, this entire mansion, I'm sorry, not Vithal Rao, Pandurang Vithal his name is, I'm sorry, okay. Professor Pandurang Vithal.
Mm.
So Swami shows him this entire mansion, and then Swami says, this mansion is your heart. And then Swami says, in one room in this mansion, you have your family, your immediate family. In another room, you have your extended family. In another room, you have your professional colleagues and friends. And in one room, you have Swami. So Swami gave the picture that one another room, you have given it to Swami among the many rooms.
Hmm.
And Swami said, if this is the place you give Swami, then that is the place Swami will also give you. And that is the distance you will have from Swami. And that's where the dream ended. So he woke up with this understanding that he is giving a very limited importance to Swami in his own life.
Mm.
And immediately he called up that family and told them that he will not be able to come because this is more important, to be at Swami's 75th birthday. Right? But the same thing, you know, the importance that we give to Swami is, are we giving another corner in our life to Swami, or are we giving the center of our life to Swami? And that makes all the difference.
Beautiful story. Now when you say the name as Mr. Panduranga Vithal, yeah, I also remember him. I think in the Department of Commerce, he was a visiting faculty. Going ahead with the conversation, Hislop says, Swami gives three stages of evolution beyond the human. Superhuman, cosmic and absolute. What does superhuman mean? So the stages of evolution are apparently you become human, then superhuman, then cosmic and the absolute being the Atman, oneness with God. Swami says, superhuman is a stage of complete detachment from body and the world. Something may be said or done at this stage to benefit humanity and the world, but the superhuman is no longer a part of the world of men, nor involved in the interests of men. And Hislop asks, are there such people now? And Swami says, oh yes. So, you know, we often think that such people don't exist because we don't see them. We have our own idea of how such superhuman should be. And because we are looking out for them with those particular physical traits and attributes, we don't seem to find them. But what Swami says is that such people are existent even now, and possibly they don't adhere to our concepts of them. In fact, I feel, you know, when we draw a concept of what is a divine being, what is a spiritual being, we actually get pulled into Maya of two different kinds. One kind is we miss out the truly superhuman divine beings because they're not matching, you know, possibly because they're not wearing a particular kind of dress or having a particular physical feature or talking in one particular manner with a deep bass voice possibly. I don't know, all these things. That is one side. The other side is we get sucked into following people who are imitators, mm-hmm. who fool us by donning these precise characteristics which are generally believed to be the persona of divine beings, you know. If you say sage in India, if you say a sage or a rishi, the first image that comes in mind is of a 50-55-year-old with long white beard and mustache and hair, wearing bark clothes. So we think that is what is a sage. I cannot imagine a person wearing a white shirt and pant who is 30 years of age, you know, neatly combed and talking fluent English to be a sage. So we, in this process, we miss out some actual sages, and there are people who can fool us by dressing according to our likes and desires. You know, right. I am reminded of Dr. John Hislop himself when he writes in his book, My Baba and I, on how he saw Swami the first time. One line that struck me in his description of Swami is, he says that in his presence, you feel only positive things. I found that as a very, very unique description. Hislop found Swami at the end of a long, lifelong spiritual search. And he says that it would be very difficult for anybody to feel anything negative in the presence of Bhagwan. That statement, I say, is very, very significant, because I felt that it clearly shows that a divine being is an experience. A divine being is not about the physical attributes. Yes, once you get that experience, you start loving that form. And we say God is a five-foot being with an orange robe with a halo of black hair. Yes. Or we say God is a very tall Ajanubahu with a Kodanda bow with an arrow. Those forms we make in order to represent that experience that we got. We keep Swami's form in our mind because Swami's form takes us back in our heart to that experience that we felt in his presence. So this is very, very important, because Hislop's description of Swami is an experience and not any physical or other attributes. I feel that's why it so happens that, you know, Swami is saying that there are such people now, but Hislop is asking whether really such people are there, because they don't adhere to the standard physical attributes that we think a divine personage or a superhuman should be. And in that very process, we miss out actual superhumans because they don't adhere to our own image of them.
And also, you know, the idea that we have of what is human itself is pretty contorted. Apparently, once somebody had said that, you know, the famous statement, to err is human. Mm. And in response to that, Swami said, who told you this? To err is not human. You know, human is the step that is just below the divine state. To err is not human. And you think that that's the state of a human life. And in one discourse, Swami gives that beautiful categorization of the various types of human beings. He says, animal, demonic, human, and then divine. Right? So in that, Swami says, what is the human state? Human state is one who follows Satya, Dharma, Shanti, Prema. So the human state itself is a dharmic person. It is not like, I'm a human, I'm a dharmic human. So he says, being dharmic is human. Being morally sound and morally just is what a human state is. Animal state is you're living like an animal, you know, just your pleasures. Demonic is when you start using your intelligence to put down others and then further your own self-interest.
Worse than animal.
Worse than animal. And then divine state is what we are trying to reach, where Swami says that, you know, you completely, what Swami is speaking of here as the superhuman state, where you're not attached to the body, you're acting from that state of understanding, higher understanding.
In fact, I just got this little paragraph of Hislop's description of his first meeting with Swami.
Mm-hmm.
He says, it is difficult and probably impossible to express in words the effect upon myself of that first meeting with Baba. My entire being was profoundly affected and changed. Immediately, Baba became the center of my life and has remained so. In his presence at that first meeting, the world fell away from me. My entire consciousness was drawn inward, and at the most subtle level of awareness, Baba appeared in my heart as pure love. Now, this description actually reinforces what Hislop felt, because even when he heard of Swami first, as he records in his book, he says that in 1968 or something, he heard about Swami first from a lady for whom Swami had materialized some vibhuti and holy ash.
Mm-hmm.
And being a serious spiritual practitioner, Hislop was not, you know, amazed or attracted to the fact that Swami materialized vibhuti. But he says that when she said that he effected a transformation in my heart, my nature has changed, Hislop felt that I must travel to India immediately and look at this being. Because he said that if there is a person on this earth who through his presence and words is able to effect a transformation of the heart, oh, this is out of the world. So you see, he, because of his lifelong sadhana, being a sadhaka, it was very clear in him that divinity is an experience that brings about transformation. And when we see, when we hear Swami saying that, you know, my love, the transformation in your heart, that is my greatest miracle. At the beginning, it just is a dialogue that we possibly parrot. But I think as we grow spiritually, we will realize that all other things are probably siddhis which can be attained, not just spiritually. You know, the way technology is progressing, I think science and technology itself will reach a level where these siddhis can be performed. Where you just think of it and the air conditioner comes on, light comes on. It's happening through technology itself. Swami says that what you're achieving through tantras these days, people would achieve through mantras in those days. I mean, not tantras. How you achieve it through yantras these days, it can be achieved through tantra or mantra. Tantra is the technique, yantra is the technology,
right,
and mantra is the will, the thought. So it is definitely possible, and you realize that tantra, mantra, yantra is not about divinity. It is possible to be attained even at human levels. So that was very, very clear. That is why, you know, after that, Hislop asked this question, the superhuman people, are they those people in the Himalayan mountains who can be invisible and do extraordinary things we hear about? And Swami says, no, those individuals are still seeking liberation, but it is temporary. Hislop says, temporary, Swami? This is awful, to get liberation and then lose it. And then Swami says, there are three kinds of liberation. The first kind is that which is experienced in a type of samadhi. The second is, a person who is engaged in sadhana can suddenly, like a flash of lightning, have a clear vision of the truth. But it fades and ordinary life resumes. And the third is, I think, what Swami refers to as the permanent liberation. He says, the third, that is liberation, which is permanent. Liberation cannot be permanent without total surrender.
Right. And this is a very profound statement that Swami makes. And one thing is, you know, we often, as you rightly said in the beginning, we have our image of who are the ones who are evolved, who are the ones who are the superhuman, a certain kind of attire, a certain kind of dressing style, grooming style, and all of that. So even going by that, you know, cliche thinking that we have, Hislop asked this question, Swami, what about the Himalayan masters we read about, the yogis and all that? Swami says they are also aspirants. They are also maybe a little more advanced. They are a little more committed maybe than people like us who are still living in the society and trying to do a little bit of sadhana. They are more focused in that sense. But nevertheless, they are also aspirants. Swami is talking about a level which is much higher, where you don't step out of. And this is probably the typical description of liberation itself.
Hmm.
That which when comes can never go. And one of the classic examples that is often given is that of seeds that are fried or seeds that are roasted. They can never germinate again. So jnana that is acquired, the true liberation is that which puts an end to this germination process altogether. And that's what it's spoken of. One which comes and never leaves is jnana, and one when it leaves, never comes back is Maya, as they say.
Beautiful.
Right? So Swami is speaking of that liberation, but this is also a very beautiful thing. And Swami would, I think even in Jnanavaini, Swami says this, that during the process of sadhana, at some point you find that deep sense of bliss that you experience. It is a bliss still in the mind level, because the mind is actually visualizing or coming into contact with something so pure, there is a chance that you mistake that to be the ultimate state. And that's one of the reasons why they say a guru is important, who when you get stuck in positions like that and you think that this is the ultimate, who is able to tell you that there is still a journey ahead. Right? And Swami is, in fact, what Swami is saying ahead of this is more profound, but we'll come to that.
In fact, you know, when Swami is saying about these temporary liberations, I was reminded of the experience of a couple of our teachers. You know, for example, there is Kishore sir, who used to teach in the university before.
Right.
He had this experience of divine union, you know, in a process which the whole experience came about very strangely. He had it not once but twice, you know, and both the times Swami had hinted to him. The first one happened suddenly, the second one Swami had hinted to him that during Guru Purnima I will give you a taste of that experience. So it was something that was conferred to him by Bhagwan. I will not go into the details of that experience now, because I think that will take up almost 15-20 minutes itself. In the same way, there is Bhagya sir. I think his experience he has also narrated. We also narrated a couple of times in various satsangs, where Swami gave him a taste of what it means to be a Jivan Mukta, meaning being part of the world but not of the world exactly. You are beyond the world, though your body continues to live in the world. And in both the cases, after that experience, they got a taste of what it was. Then, as Bhagya sir puts it, he returned to abnormalcy. Because he says, once you experience that, everything in this mundane world feels so abnormal and you feel like striving for that. And even to this day, as you speak to him, you realize that he's in constant endeavor to achieve that. He's striving towards that. So these are possible. So they have actually tasted that. They have seen what it is. But it is only momentary, temporary, as Swami says. What Swami says is, without total surrender, you can't have liberation. And when you have that total surrender, it doesn't matter whether you are sitting in the Himalayas, or you are sitting and working in the studio, or you are sitting and working for a multinational company. Because the example there, I think it was discussed between Hislop and Swami only in a previous episode, where Swami gives the example of Janaka, Emperor Janaka, a Jivan Mukta, meaning a person who is leading his life normally, but he is liberated. And once he got that Jivan Mukta, once he became Jivan Mukta, Swami says that he lived for only about 21 days, if I'm not mistaken, after that. Because Swami says that when you become a Jivan Mukta, you get so detached from the world that there are people needed who come and sustain your body. Else you have totally lost your attachment to the body. You don't feel hunger, you don't feel thirst, because you are one with your true self, not the body. I'm sorry, I don't think it's in this conversations book. It was in a discourse that I had read.
Okay.
A discourse in which Swami speaks about Vedavyasa and Narada. Mm-hmm. In that, Swami speaks of a Jivan Mukta. Swami says, in 21 days, a Jivan Mukta's body goes. Simply because the Jivan Mukta is not taking care of the body at all, because there's no body consciousness left at all. The body is just allowed to wither away. Unless there is someone else who feels that that body is important and nourishes and sustains that body. So, and Janaka, Emperor Janaka, was a ruler. He was ruling over an entire kingdom. So, that makes it very evident that it is not as if only those who give up everything and sit in Prashanti Nilayam or go to the Himalayas and meditate. It's not like that. Liberation is available for all those who yearn and seek. And when true liberation comes, nothing else matters. Your age, your gender, your whatever nationality, race, religion, nothing matters. It can be conferred on all. And that is what Swami says here, that there is temporary liberation, there is permanent liberation. All said and done, temporary liberation is still better than not having experienced it, because at least it gives you a taste of that, and it intensifies the yearning in your heart to achieve it on a permanent basis.
And then Hislop goes on to ask, then if not the people in the Himalayas, who are the superhumans? Then he says, Swami names a half a dozen or so of ancient sages. He doesn't record the names as such. Then Swami says, these people were totally above human and worldly life. Although for the benefit of others, they would give certain advice and engage in certain actions. Then Hislop says, but Swami, that was a long time ago. Are there superhumans in this day and age? Swami says, oh yes, there are. But today, outwardly they live in society and outwardly cannot be recognized. So he doesn't record the names of those sages, but I think many times Swami does mention, as you said, Janaka is one of them that Swami often says. In fact, he is one of the few people mentioned even in some of the Vedantic texts as a person who attained that state and continued to function as a normal person. And Swami also says that there are people like that even today. Many times this question has been asked, Swami would never mention names, but Swami will always say, so many are there. You don't know them, you don't recognize them, but there are many like that.
In fact, if those many were not there, why would the avatar come? Because I think even in Bhagavata Vahini Satsang, and repeatedly we have seen how Swami says that the primary reason why the avatar comes is to sustain the good people. If there are no enough good people, why will the avatar ever come? The very fact that the avatar has come shows that there are so many people like that around. Hislop then asks, what is the cosmic stage? Because right in the beginning, after the human, Swami says there are three levels, which is superhuman, cosmic, and the absolute. The absolute is easy to understand theoretically at least, whether nothing exists, it's oneness with God. So we saw what superhuman state, where a person doesn't exist selfishly. A person leads his or her life normally as per the worldly duties, but does everything selflessly for others' benefit. And because they are involved in their worldly duties, we might not identify them anywhere in society, because it might be a cobbler who is mending your shoes, it might be the prime minister who is ruling your nation, it might be the tailor who is stitching your clothes, the shopkeeper who is selling you the wares, it could be anybody. They just do it, but with the attitude of total detachment and without any attachment and selfishness. Then the next stage is the cosmic stage, and Hislop asks, what is the cosmic stage? And Swami says, no body, no mind. Both have disappeared. Body, feelings, mind, intelligence are no longer there. Just love, just spirituality. And Hislop says, are there entities, individuals in the cosmic stage? And Swami says, no. No individuals. It's more similar to currents of spiritual power. So when we say the cosmic stage, the difference between superhuman stage and cosmic stage is, Swami says, there is no body also. Then how do they exist? They exist like how electric currents exist. An electric current can flow through a wire, can flow through a rod, can flow through anything. So I think this is what happens. You know, many times we feel that some great sages and saints, in fact, when I was reading the Shirdi Sai Satcharitra, there the author mentions about how all the great saints and sages, when they find a person who is amenable and in tune with the Lord, they choose to reveal themselves to the world through those people. And he writes, it is only such people who get the opportunity to write biographies of saints, because the saint has to will it, the sage has to will it. So those sages and saints are gone 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 500 years ago. So how is that they exist? I felt that is what possibly Swami is referring to. This is my understanding. I might be wrong. But it felt convincing for me that this is possibly what Swami is referring to, as they exist as currents. They can flow through any wire. If the wire has conductivity, if it's a good conductor, it will flow through. And you know, even in Shirdi Baba's life itself, we see that. I was watching Shirdi Baba's movie. I've watched it multiple times. In fact, it's a movie that has been produced by our Swami only. Of course, through the Sarala Charities Trust. But in that movie, we see multiple times Shirdi Baba saying things like, if Shiva wills, it will happen. And then he gives Udhi. And with that Udhi, the person who has suffered a snake bite, it's a Kulkarni, an accountant of the village, he recovers from the snake bite. So on the face of it is Shirdi Baba who gave the vibhuti, but he says if Lord Shiva wills, it will happen. It's very, very evident that Shirdi Baba is saying that I am just a conduit for the current of Lord Shiva to pass through. To some others, he says Allah Malik, if Allah wills. Different gods, you know. He refers to Datta, he refers to Devi, he refers to so many gods. I just felt that is also the avatar playing the role wherein he says that there is current flowing through. So Swami says the first level is a superhuman where it is a body which is living selflessly. The second level is the cosmic stage where there is no body, no mind, but it is there. The presence is there as a pulsating energy or current which flows through different people, different things as and when necessary when it happens. And that is the second, which is the cosmic stage.
Right. And this conversation continues where Hislop goes on to ask, well, the absolute is Swami. That is understood. When Swami says he will confer liberation at death, what does that mean? So, as we said, the third one is absolute, and Hislop says that, you know, that is understandable that the absolute is Swami. But then he goes on to ask about a promise or a blessing that Swami often gives, that, you know, I'll give you moksha, or there is no more birth after this. So he's asking about that liberation. And Swami says it means that birth is finished. There is no birth again. Then Hislop says, but Swami, there is this temporary liberation that was mentioned. Maybe it is that kind. And Swami says, no, it is not like that. Sai gives total final liberation. Hislop says, could there be the ending of individuality too? Swami says, there could be. And then Hislop says, individuality is a nuisance. And Swami concurs, yes, individuality is a nuisance. So, a few interesting exchanges there where Swami says that whenever he says that this is, Swami can give you the Sadgati or the final state, Swami is referring to the final liberation. It is not the temporary liberation or the vision that Swami spoke of. And but the individuality might or might not go is what Swami says. This again is something which is not necessarily completely understood by us. At least I don't personally claim to have understanding of this, because Swami says that there are many stages. Like when you read about many of these saints, often it is spoken of as the saint and then goes and dwells in Vaikuntha or in Shivaloka and things like that, where probably that individuality remains, but that individual does not assume a form again and get into the worldly life again.
When Hislop asks Swami that, when Swami says he'll confer liberation at death, what does that mean? It is possible that Hislop was thinking that when Swami gives liberation, does a human become a superhuman or the cosmic or the absolute? And Swami makes it very clear that when Swami grants it, it is reaching final liberation. Then, for that, the way I understood was that it has to be a two-way effort. Swami would often say that the individual is the negative current. Negative current means the negative electrode, one polarity. God's grace is the other positive, the other polarity. When both come together, only there's a flow of current that happens. Meaning everything requires human effort and this. So, when Swami grants, he confers it, but it is left to each individual to overcome one's own ego, one's own body attachment, because if that doesn't happen, it's of possibly not much use. I remember when Swami did the Lingodbhavam in 1999, when he restarted it. Mm-hmm. Till then it had been discontinued. After that Lingodbhavam, Swami announced that those who had seen the lingam emerge from his mouth till the completion, till it comes to his hand, that whole thing, those who have witnessed, they are liberated, Swami said. They have been gifted with liberation. And we were also excited because we had seen it. And I remember on one occasion when Silas sir, who was our teacher, he was speaking to us. He said, you should not do this, you should not do that. One of the students got up and asked, sir, why should we bother about what we do now? We are anyway got liberation. We can do whatever we want. And he said, no, it is for that point in time. The way he explained it is, when Swami said he has given you liberation, at that point in time, possibly all your karmas, everything wiped out, everything, you're a clean slate. You are ready to go. But after that, again, you use your mind and, you know, like that Maili Chadar Odke Kaise song, which is there, which says that, Lord, you gave me this beautiful chadar or shawl, but over time, I have dirtied it so much, made it so dirty. In that song, he's referring to the chadar or the shawl as the body and the mind. Mm. In the same way, Sailesar was telling us that if you think that now you can do whatever, no, you're again, you're getting back into that. You're getting back into the muddy puddle. I was reminded of that when I read this, because I felt that the Lord has the capacity to confer that. But if we have not made enough efforts to deserve it, even after getting it, we will slip back to where we are. It's like giving $1 million possibly to a person who has no knowledge of how to do financial investing. He may become immediately rich, but in a matter of few months, he will get swindled of his money, he will lose his money and end up as a pauper again. Therefore, it makes sense that a gift like $1 million is given to a person who is worthy and who knows how to use it such a way that never again he will see poverty in his life. I feel that is what Swami also does. He has the capacity to instantly grant us that state. But if we are not tuned enough to receive it, it'll take us again matter of time before we get back to the state of spiritual poverty. That's why we also should, it's a two-way thing, the negative, the positive electrodes, our effort being met with His grace. When that happens, I think, that is the case when we hear of Subbamma's story or different people whom Swami has come and conferred, when that being is ripe and reached that level, then He confers the ultimate, so that there is no coming back again after that.
The conversation continues from here, but dear listeners, don't go away. We'll take a short break and we'll continue our discussion about the conversation. And we'll take a small break. Listen to this bhajan. Don't go away. We'll come back after this.
Jayama Jayama Jagadishwari Sai Ma
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 Jagadishwari Maheshwari Sai Shwari 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 Sai Ma
Jagadishwari Sai Ma
Welcome back, dear listeners. You just heard a beautiful bhajan, lovely rendition by Brother Ashwat as part of the Bhajan A Day channel. And if you want to listen to more bhajans like that, you just have to go and subscribe to our Bhajan A Day, the Shri Satya Sai Bhajans YouTube channel, and many, many such soulful renditions there. We'll continue with our discussion here, and Hislop also continues with his questioning. The question now he poses is, one of Swami's statements is not understood. Swami has said that man is born with a dual gift from God, discrimination and conscience. And that because of conscience, everyone knows right from wrong. For if he were to do wrong, his conscience would trouble him. Swami replies, yes, that is the case. Hislop pursues then, but people point out, Swami, that people of one religion kill people of another religion, and they do it because their conscience tells them that it is right to do so. Swami says, it is not that way. When such things occur, it is because the individual has surrendered his judgment to someone else or to an idea propagated by someone. If the person were to reject ideas and rely upon himself, his conscience, even though deeply buried, would be there to prompt the person For conscience is God, resident in the person. So, again, this I think is a question that, I don't know whether it was asked earlier in this conversation itself or we have discussed it otherwise, because this is again some point that Swami always says, that the Lord is manifest in each person as the conscience. In fact, it's a Vedantic topic that Swami has spoken about and explained in some of his Vahinis. The Lord is present as the Atma, but the conscience is the voicing of the Atma, Antarvani, as Swami would say. Is the God is ever present and the conscience is always saying what is right and wrong. A lot of people say this, what about the criminals, what about the terrorists, and is there no conscience? It is always a case of the conscience not being heeded to. It is never a conscience of, never a question of the conscience being absent.
Absolutely. Swami says that the conscience is absolute, but because the individual has surrendered his judgment to someone else or to an idea propagated by someone else, he thinks that there is no conscience and he thinks that I am doing what is right. This was so powerfully proved scientifically also. Mm-hmm. In an experiment that has become very popularly known as the Milgram experiment.
Okay.
It was conducted by Stanley Milgram at the Yale University in July 1961-63, in the 2 year period.
Okay.
And it was precisely on this, on obedience and personal conscience. So the experiment went like this. What he would do is, the subjects of the experiment were people in the age group 20 to 50. For some reason he took only males. So males in the age group 20 to 50 who range from unskilled people to professionals. So everybody across all professions. Now he would set up a kind of role play wherein there is a learner and a teacher. And invariably it would be through lots that the learner and teacher would be decided. And always it would happen that these test subjects would become the teachers and the learner would be an actor that is employed by the experimenter. So when once that was done, the actor who is playing the role of a learner would go into a room where questions would be asked and he has to give answers. And the teacher is sitting in front of a circuit board with switches marked with different voltages. 2 volts, 5 volts, 10 volts, 20 volts. Every time the learner gives a wrong answer, the teacher is supposed to give an electric shock.
Okay.
To the person who is learning inside.
Mm-hmm.
One shock, mild shock. And the second wrong answer, a stronger shock. Third wrong answer, a stronger shock. The 300 volt was marked with something saying danger. And 450 volt meant death. Death to the person. And of course, the whole thing was rigged in the sense that there was no shock being given. But the actor would act as if he received a shock. And then the experimentation began.
Mm-hmm.
So the professor is asking the questions, the learner is giving the answers, and based on right or wrong, the teacher who is playing the role, that is the actual subject, he is putting it. So a 2 volt shock and that person winces a little bit inside. It's like how we feel when we touch something that is not earthed properly. But as the shock level keeps going up, the person is acting so dramatically and this person is able to see that, oh my God, the shock that I'm giving is causing so much pain. So at around 50 volt level, the person hesitates. The teacher is hesitating to give the shock. Even as he's hesitating, he hears a voice which comes and says, it was the voice which says, it was a prodding voice which says, please continue, please continue. So, okay, this is a part of the experiment, I'm supposed to continue. But once it reaches something like 70 volts, 100 volts, he sees the person suffering so much, he's about to withdraw, again the voice comes, the experiment requires you to continue. Precisely these words. Delivered in a firm but polite tone. The person continues. The third prod that would come, if they are again hesitant for the third time, would be, it is absolutely essential that you continue. And finally, you know, sometime when it reaches 300 volts, it's very scary. When they are refusing, the final prod would be, listen, you have no other choice. You have to continue. And Professor Stanley Milgram found that 65% of the subjects across from unskilled to the professionals went ahead giving the deadly shock which would kill a person, you know, and they would see the person die. But when they were asked about remorse, they said, I was just following orders. I mean, I didn't do, I It's not, the responsibility is not on me. So he concluded by saying that if there is a powerful authority which you have conviction and faith in, then that authority can simply make you overrule all your sense of morality, ethics and conscience. That is the word that has been used by Professor Stanley Milgram. You overrule, and in 65% of the cases, only in 35% of the cases, reaching 300 volts, would the person get up and say, no, I can't do this, I'm walking out, whatever be the consequence. Even though they are warned that, no, you're disobeying authority. So this is, I think, a very big eye-opening experience from a scientific perspective to both people in authority and people who are subjected to authority. People in authority, be very careful, don't misuse power. And people who are subjected to authority, be very careful, unknowingly don't overrule your conscience in the name of authority. Because that is what Swami is saying here. Swami says, when such things occur, it is because the individual has surrendered his judgment to someone else or to an idea propagated by someone else. The conscience is always there.
There's this very interesting image somebody had made, a very graphic representation of something which is said in some of the Upanishads of the conscience and the intelligence and intellect. It is almost like this, you know, imagine the intellect to be a mirror. And this mirror has two light sources. And one light source is the conscience, and the other light source is the worldly input that we get, right? Somebody telling us what to do, or some influence from outside. It could be religious influence, it could be influence based on what we read, what we hear in news and all of that. So they say that this is the setup inside the mind. You have the buddhi always decides whether to do or not do, what is right and what is wrong, what needs to be acted upon. But this buddhi is a mirror that gets input from both places. And oftentimes what happens is we choose to ignore the input that comes from the conscience, and we choose to act upon what is coming from outside. And Swami very clearly says that over a period of time, we kind of lose the habit of listening to the conscience, or lose the habit of turning to the conscience at the time of making a decision. So much so that we think that it is non-existent and it is not there. And leading a conscientious life is nothing more than just practice. And the more and more you turn to the conscience, the more and more it becomes more obvious to you and more imminent and louder and clearer when a decision needs to be taken. So it is never a case of the conscience not being there. And that is why Swami would say that, it is like a Swami is sitting inside you and always telling you what is right and wrong. So you can never hold Swami and say, Swami, you did not tell me. It is always the case of you did not listen to me. That's all. And that's why he can always pull us up and say that I told you, you did not listen. It is only his kindness that he doesn't do that all the time.
In fact, speaking of this conscience, I don't know the name. I remember a story written by, I think, O. Henry, called The Telltale Heart.
Okay.
So it's about a person who murders another person, but gets to know that the police is coming there. So he quickly lifts some wooden boards and puts the body there and covers back the wooden board. And the entire story is about how the police come and search his place. But this person is all the while tensed because he's able to hear the heartbeat of the dead person. And he's trying all his efforts to cover up that sound by making other sounds. In fact, you know, as a reader, you realize that it's only him who is hearing the heartbeat of the dead person, because the dead person has no heartbeat. That is, in fact, I mean, I have destroyed all the poetry that is there in the story. But the author clearly shows that when you have a guilty conscience, it is so loud that you feel, how is it that the others don't know that I'm guilty? The guilt is seen in your face. Towards the end of the story, the man is arrested by the police because though they are not able to hear any heartbeat, all the signs and symptoms that this person exhibits clearly shows him as the killer. So I think that story was also named as The Telltale Heart. So that is how the conscience is. We may do multiple efforts to drown its voice and may even succeed in doing it, but we will never succeed in silencing it, because Swami says that is the presence of God within you. It will keep speaking.
Right. And what Swami defines as good company is also just that. Right. Nobody is going to come and tell you something which you don't already know. Right. When you're wondering what is the right thing to do, in the role that we play, a lot of people come and ask us, you know, what would Swami want us to do? this is my situation, what should I do? It is never the case that you don't know, right? The input from outside, if it amplifies the voice of the conscience, it is good company. If the input from outside is drowning it and is turning you away from that, it's bad company. It's as simple as that.
Very nicely said. Going ahead, Hislop says, throughout the world, crime is growing rapidly. But in America, there is doubt about how to deal with criminals. How should criminals be dealt with? And Swami says, there must be punishment. In areas of the Middle East, for example, if a person commits a crime of theft, the hand is cut off. When a person commits a crime, punishment must follow. So, right, nothing more to explain.
Right. This is some topic which, it's a raging debate in the sense of so much is being read into crime. How do you differentiate between a person of sound mind being a criminal and a person whose mind is no more capable of making right decisions, and then it has become, that line is becoming so much more thin, right? Because crime is being taken to, you know, the influence from childhood, this person had a broken family, and so it is. So where do you fix the responsibility? But when Swami is speaking about, or even when we speak about punishment, punishment is both ways. It is for the individual and it is also a deterrent in society. Right? So in that sense, Swami would always say that punishment is important. Even in bringing up children, Swami has always maintained that there should be a little bit of, discipline, strict disciplining that is important. And Swami would so sweetly say, there should be love, there should also be law. Only then there will be good progress.
Spare the rod, spoil the child, as the right. proverb goes. Going ahead, I think this is a different context, a different day, because the theme changes quite abruptly. Hislop says, Swami, people are thinking that after the 60th birthday, that is Bhagwan's 60th birthday, Bhagwan will step away from contact with the world and that his devotees will no longer have access to him. Swami responds, no, not at all. Sai is not separating from the world, nor will he separate from his devotees. The course of an avatar goes invariably through the same stages. It is the same for every avatar at all times. The first 16 years are characterized by constant leelas. Then leelas and teachings up to age 45. From age 45 to 60, the emphasis is almost wholly on teaching. At age 60, there is a very big change. How, Swami? Hislop asks. And he also records that Sai listed some things I should not repeat. But then after that, Swami says, after age 60, Sai will directly give added strength to the minds of those persons who are actively working with him. Now is starting a time of change. It is just as when a strong wind comes up and blows away the husks, leaving behind only the sound kernels. In these times, many devotees will fall away from Sai, leaving only those devotees whose faith is sound and solid. Have you not yourself noted a change? In the early years, Sai came to your room to talk to you. Now, you come to the veranda each day and Sai does not even stop and speak with you. Such changes occur in the different stages of the avatar.
Right, I think this is something which many of our lecturers and seniors who were there around this time also speak of. Almost every fifth year, this rumor will start. After 60th birthday, after 50th birthday, after 65th birthday, Swami will withdraw himself. And I recall one of our teachers telling, I think it was 65th, when again this rumor was, very strong. And this used to be a kind of thing that would cause panic in the hostel. Because if Swami were to withdraw, the most hate would be the students. Right? So there was always that fear. And apparently on the day after Swami's 65th birthday or something, Swami just made a casual visit to the hostel, almost putting to rest all the fears that the students must have had, saying that he's always available, right? And as Swami is saying here, I mean, we technically belong to the period after this, when Swami is speaking of the excess will reduce and all of that. But you never can claim that you felt distant from Swami. Yes, physically the chances are reducing. Physically access is being withdrawn to a certain extent. But never Swami is inaccessible. Never one can feel distant from Swami. And I think that's what Swami is saying here. Swami is always dear to his devotees. And we can say this as students, and we can say this also as people who have met so many devotees who are so much more closer to Swami, even though physically far away, than people who probably have been blessed with physical proximity but not dearness, as Swami would say.
When Swami says that at age 60, there is a very big change. You know, when we think of the 60th birthday, 65th birthday, that's when all the projects,
right,
gargantuan projects of social welfare that have happened, all these have happened. And then, as you said, 60th birthday, 65th birthday, each time they kept saying that after the Swami will become far, Swami will become far. You know, sometimes with a kind of sadness in my heart, I just feel that that really happened after the 85th birthday. Just yesterday, I was going through a few photographs of Swami on the stage during the 85th birthday, and I was just going back to 10 years ago and thinking how none of us had even the slightest inkling that this would be the last ever birthday of the Lord, Lord's physical form. So possibly 85th birthday was a time when there were no such rumors, you know, that Swami is going to become distant, Swami is going to go on top of a hill. All these are different rumors that had come up, that he'll be in a 1,000-pillared mandir that is set up very far above and all that. I don't remember any such thing that happened before the 85th birthday, and then he was gone physically. But that statement that he says there, after age 60, so Bhagwan's age 60 would possibly 1985 or 1986, Swami is saying, Sai will directly give added strength to the minds of those persons who are actively working with him. You know, this is a reiteration of the statement, if you need me, you deserve me. Swami is saying that all you need to have is the desire to actively work for him, that's all. Your history, your geography, your birth, your nothing matters. Go into your heart. Examine if you have that desire to actively work for him. If that is there, Swami is saying that he will directly give added strength to the minds of the people who are actively working with him. So it really is a very, very encouraging and enthusing statement for all of us, because we realize that Swami himself has stated what one needs to do to be dear and close to him. Just have that intense yearning to work for him, work with him, and he will connect. You know, connecting with us is his job. He will do it. So I think that is a real big change after age 60, after Bhagwan's age 60, because possibly till then, even in a physical level, it was about coming here and spending time absorbing. But Swami says that for various reasons, while doing Satya to Sai, I think we realize that early years of Swami, we get a linear kind of story. But even as early as 1945-46, we find it difficult to keep track, because Swami's mission starts exploding and going along multiple branches, and you don't know, each branch leads you to one line of thought and one line of narration, and there are so many branches. I think it only grew more complex and complicated as years passed, and maybe, I just assume that 60th year was a kind of landmark year after which it becomes impossible to trace. But you can rest assured that your connection with Swami is strong if you have that yearning and desire to work with him, work for him.
Right. Technically speaking, you know, if you look at Swami, the recognition of Swami or seeing Swami or knowing Swami in our life is not like knowing another individual. Right? If you know him as another individual, as a friend that you meet or as an acquaintance that you develop, then you can miss him, or then you can say that, okay, now there was proximity and now there isn't proximity. But the very fact that you recognize Swami is to recognize him as being all around you. Right? That is the gift that Swami is giving. The only gift that is worthwhile that we are taking away from Swami is this, that he has come and shown us that he is there. He's there all around you, right? So in that sense, this knowledge or this interaction with Swami is to show us that he is omnipresent, he is all around us, he is within us. And that is why it is, in that sense, you can never be far away from Swami, or the step ahead is never that which is going to distance you from Swami. every progressive step that we're taking is only closer to this realization. So philosophically also what Swami is saying here, it makes no sense in that, in looking at it from that point of view.
In fact, it takes me back to the beginning of today's satsang, where Hislop is telling, Swami gives three stages of evolution, superhuman, cosmic, absolute. I just felt that our experience or opinion of Swami also goes through these evolution. You know, possibly we started off by thinking that, you know, Swami is a human like any one of us. And then we go to a level thinking, oh yeah, Swami is a superhuman. He can do these things. And then in the present state of physical absence, especially, we start seeing that cosmic nature of Bhagwan, because Swami defines the cosmic nature as that current that exists all around you. And I think from there you have to progress to the level where we realize that he is the absolute. I mean, it's not even like a current that you feel now and then. You realize that what is there other than Swami in the universe. That is the evolution that we have to undergo, go through. And while in this conversation it came as things that we become, I think it could also be interpreted as how we view Swami. When we view Swami as a human, we remain at a human level. As a human, a social worker who has done so much of good, I think that defines our own level as well. When we view him as a superhuman, we become superhuman. When we view him as the cosmic one, we become cosmic. And when we are able to truly understand and recognize that absolute, we also become absolute. Because Swami says, Yad bhavam tad bhavati. Yantamatramuna yavara talachina antamatrame nivu. How much you think of, whatever you think of the Lord, what is the extent of your thought about the Lord, that is what you become, that is what the Lord also becomes. So I think these two are tied very, very closely, because they are separate only as long as we have this dvaita or duality. Once we get to that unifying vision, there is nothing like God, there is nothing like devotee, it's all one. So I feel in that sense, in the dual world, we can view this from this perspective as well, that our understanding of Swami has to grow from him being a human to a superhuman, to the cosmic one, to the absolute.
Right. And then Hislop goes on to ask, in the same conversation, Swami has said that the entire world will know of his presence. At this time, only a relatively few people know of Sai. As of now, only local individuals represent him, and they do not draw the attention of people of substance and importance throughout the world. Swami responds, Sai does not look at status and worldly importance. He looks at the heart. Yes, Swami, but it is the leaders in society who tend to arouse the attention and interest of the general population. Swami says, Sai does not force such things. He will be in body for many more years. What you refer to will develop naturally. Devotees of world stature, able to speak of Sai, will be present when the time is correct for them. Right, a very beautiful conversation. This is something that often it comes to our mind, because we think that the avatar has come and this is too few a number. There should be more people. It should be a world phenomenon. But if you historically see, comparatively, this avatar is much, drawing more people from more diverse backgrounds than there has been. You know, whenever you read Bhagavatam, the entire Vamana avatar comes in a flash and goes away. The Narsimha avatar comes and goes away merely for one devotee, right? Just for one Prahlada, he comes, he satisfies that and he goes away. I mean, that is the love of the Lord. One devotee, one pure heart can draw. And it is we who always think in terms of quantity, right? Oh, million people know Swami. I mean, more and more we are living in a world where numbers have no meaning. You just have to go to social media and see how many million follow what kind of people, right? Mm. There is no meaning or rhyme or reason in the numbers that go behind people, right? So Swami is saying here that it might happen if it is required, if it is necessary for more people to get to know of Swami. The right people will come at the right time and speak about Swami and represent Swami. But for Swami, it means nothing.
Right? Beautiful, because I think when Swami is saying when the time is correct for them.
Them, right.
Not for Swami's. It reminds me of a beautiful letter or message from Swami that inspired Charles Penn. It's recorded in his book and it is quite popular. It is there on the internet as well. I'm not sure whether it was actually a letter that Swami wrote to him or whether it was inspired in his meditation, but the words are very, very beautiful. Words of Swami to the devotees. And this being 1979, I believe it was referred to Bhagwan by the devotees, and you know, it that way has the physical permission of Bhagwan. So the words go like this: Your mission has begun. These are my words to you, my devotees. Each of you has a unique and valuable part to play in this lifetime. Only those whom I have called can serve me. My mission has now reached that point in time when each of you has work to do. This planet has a purpose in the great galaxy in which it is held. The purpose is now unfolding before our eyes. I call upon you to radiate the bhakti within you so that its unseen power will envelop all who come into your orbit. To successfully perform your part, always remain centered upon me. Allow yourself to impart that purity of heart within you towards all human beings and all living creatures, and do not reach for the fruits of your work. This part of my mission is performed in absolute silence. You are my instruments from whom my love will pour. Be always aware that the moment you let your ego descend upon you, my work ceases. When you have overcome your negative unmindfulness, you will again become my source. The multiplication of my love will be felt throughout the world. I have prepared you for this work over many incarnations. I have drawn you to me. I have made great steps in my mission over these past incarnations. My work is ceaseless, and so your work too is without end. Know that I am within and without you. There is no difference. Rid yourselves of the petty matters forevermore. You are now in me and I am now in thee. There is no difference. My darshan will pour forth from me to and through you. You may be unaware of this constant action. Be ever pure of heart and soul, and mankind in your lifetime will benefit from your unique qualities. Others too will join me in this mission when I draw them to me. The time is approaching when all humanity will live in harmony. That time will be here sooner than one expects. Before it arrives, be prepared for whatever is needed to reveal to every living being the true purpose of existence. It's not what anyone alive can imagine. It's not something that one can try to aspire to. It is beyond all comprehension. I can say that its beauty is magnificent beyond all dreams. And as each of you perform your silent work, I embrace you to my heart, and henceforth your souls shall be lifted up and your eyes will reveal my presence within. This I say to all my devotees from the Lord's mountaintop, where all the universes become one. Be about my work, my beloved bhaktas. Your breath will carry the scent of the blossoms of heaven. Your example will be that of angels. Your joy will be my joy. So that is the beautiful letter, which I think we can keep reading and rereading over and over again if at all we feel a lack of motivation in our hearts.
Right. And going back to what Swami was saying, it may happen, it may not happen that Swami's name spreads to every corner of the world. It has spread in its own way, right? We hear many, many stories of Swami reaching out to people who may not spread the name of Swami, and many, many such instances. When we were speaking to some of these youth from Vishakhapatnam, the Anantagiri project, which now has come to light and a lot of people know about it, started in a very small way by just a group of youngsters who wanted to do something inspired by Swami. And they said, Swami has done a water project. Let's see if we can do something similar to that. They wanted to go to a very remote tribal village in the forests of Anantagiri and do a simple water project of just laying pipes from a water source somewhere in the forest to this tribal village. And they said, let's do this. No, it's not been done by the government. probably will do that today. I think they've provided water to a few hundred villages.
Wow.
Right? And it's amazing. It's one of the most inspiring work done in Swami's name. But when we spoke to those people, they said the first village we went to, first time we are going to, put this idea in front of these people and ask them, is it okay? The first village they enter, the first house in that village, on the door, there is a picture of Swami.
Wow.
Right? Saying that Swami has already reached there. Even before you even try to take Swami's name anywhere, I think we should know that Swami's name is already there in every corner. And I think that's... Will those village people be able to go and speak in the world forums about Swami? Certainly not. But it doesn't really matter to Swami. If Swami has reached out to a devotee's heart, I think Swami feels that Swami's mission is complete. And I think as reflections of Swami, we should have the same attitude. It's not about how many thousands of people we have reached out to. If through our life we have inspired transformation in one heart, I think our life itself is worthwhile. I think that's how we will reflect Swami's mission and Swami's way of thinking.
Absolutely. Going ahead, Hislop now asks Swami, I don't know how that leads to this, but anyway, he asks Swami, what were the mistakes, if any, in the teachings of the Buddha? Swami says, one mistake he made was to allow women to come close to him in the Sangha. It was a woman who gave him the meat, the poisoned meat which killed him. Hislop says, it was his custom to accept whatever was given into the begging bowl, even if it was meat. And Swami says, that was the second mistake. Here he failed to put his teaching into practice. His teaching was ahimsa, total non-violence to all creatures. Then Hislop asks, the Buddha taught that nirvana was the ultimate goal. Is that different from the liberation of which Swami speaks? And Swami says, it is the same. Nirvana, liberation, realization are just different words. Reading this, I just felt that, yes, everybody makes mistakes. And it's okay to make mistakes. What is most important is to learn and to yearn. From our discussion so far, it becomes very clear that Swami gives so much of importance to yearning. Here, the importance is being given to learning as well. Because who else but the Supreme Lord can, point out and say, this is the mistake that Buddha made. And it, on one hand, it really humbles us that we have come into the proximity, or we have got to know of such a being. At the same time, it's very encouraging for us to realize that it's okay to make mistakes when it is happening as a mistake. It's not as if to err is human. It's not that we repeatedly do, but if by chance we make a mistake, it's okay because guess what? Even Buddha made a mistake. So doesn't undo all the good that you have done. When you identify something as a mistake made, accept it, try to undo the effect of it, but move on. Don't get stuck in that. It often happens that we get caught in a cycle of regret and self-pity and beat ourselves so much over a thing that we have done. Personally, I have realized that if you want to be forgiving towards others, it has to start with you being forgiving towards your own self. As they say, charity begins at home. Not just charity, forgiveness, love, caring, everything begins at home. And at home meaning your own body, your own self. If you are not charitable and kind towards yourself, you can't be the same towards others. If you are not tolerant and having kshama towards yourself, you can't have the same towards others. So in that sense, for me, the takeaway message from this was, it's okay to make mistakes. Just ensure that you're learning and you have your yearning.
And with that, dear listeners, we'll have to conclude this week's discussion, and we most humbly offer this effort at Swami's Lotus Feet. Again, a gentle reminder, 7:30 p.m. tonight, this evening, the live satsang, the video satsang, will be presented by Arvind and myself. And we're going to talk about the history of one of the most important events that happened in Prashanthi Nilayam. You can tune into the Asia stream as you're doing right now, or you can log into our YouTube channel to watch the satsang. And definitely we would suggest that you watch the satsang, because along with the discussion, we are also going to show some beautiful images of Swami's Dashara celebrations from the yesteryears, and also some of the footage from the Yajnam that would happen at Prashanthi Nilayam. So hoping to meet you all again at 7:30 p.m. We leave you with this bhajan. On the other side of it, we'll have the rest of the programs continuing, starting with the Veda Jignasa program. Till we meet you again next week in another afternoon satsang, we hope that you keep safe and take care. Jai Sai Ram.
Durga Bhavani Ma, Jaya Jaya Sai Ma.
Durga Bhavani Ma, Jaya Jaya Sai Ma.
Durga Bhavani Ma, Jaya Jaya Sai Ma. Jaya Jaya Sai Maa.